and welcome to Dialect from the Bristol Radio Co-op. I'm Sophia Costa.
And I'm John Peters Coleman.
Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM on 103.2 FM and Radio Verulam in St Albans.
In the show this week, we have two guests. We have Anthony Smith as the first guest, who was in the studio last week, and he's come back again this week to tell us more about filming The Newcomers. Anthony, a writer, starred with his wife Alison in a documentary made by John Borman in 1964 for the BBC. The documentary, The Newcomers, featured the lives of the young couple in Bristol leading up to the birth of their twins.
Our second guest is Will Player, who is starting a new business involving the $1 bill. Features are by Tony Goslin, Michaela Dellis and Anthea Page.
Malcolm Greaves reads Part 3, Chapter 14 from Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. And Jeff Sparks is back once again with the What's On Guide. Well, welcome now to Anthony Smith, a writer and author of Labyrinth and Dark Crystal, among many other books. But first, we're going to hear a clip from the first episode of The Newcomers, which was made in 1964 by the documentary maker John Borman, who later directed lots of other famous stuff, to launch BBC Two.
This is a general view of Clifton from across the Avon, the sort of 18th century painter's view. This is a bridge, a suspension bridge from the leeward side. Royal York Crescent, showing the pedestrian and the vehicle separation.
Yeah.
Even in 1800 they managed to get what Buchanan's trying for now.
Yes, we can use that big company.
Last week, we had the first part of an interview with Anthony Smith. We had a little clip of The Newcomers, which was something that he starred in 1964, and he's here again to chat more in depth. Hello.
Hello.
So, to recap a little bit, tell us a little bit about what The Newcomers is, for people who maybe didn't hear last week.
Well, it was called The Newcomers because both Alison and I were fairly newcomers to Bristol, about 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
But it was really Borman's take very early, I mean a long time before other people, on the fact that something was happening in this country. It was changing, and he presented us as representatives of that, really. Basically, the first beneficiaries of the welfare state.
Okay, so this is back in 1964. BBC Two was about to launch.
It was the first big thing on BBC Two.
It was the first big thing on
BBC
Two.
That's why money was made available. Borman was already the blue-eyed boy of BBC documentary.
Okay.
So they wanted him to do something to put BBC Two on the map when it launched. And he said, this is it.
And the plot of it is that you're about to have twins, is that right?
Yeah, though nobody knew that when we started. We knew Alison was going to have something. I mean, but we'd already finished filming and put in the can two of the films before the hospital said, ha-ha, look at this X-ray. So that actually embarrassed Borman, because it sounded as though it was all set up and he knew and it was going to be a big drama. Wow, folks, it's twins.
Yeah.
So he deliberately defused the potential drama of that by starting the last film with a flat announcement that Alison had twins. He didn't want that to be the climax. But it excited the papers, the tabloids got terribly interested in the series, only because we were ordinary people. And what were ordinary people doing on national television? I mean, yeah, it was unheard of, you know. Only famous people were on national television.
This all sounds like, you know, quite strange for you. I mean, how did you take to the idea when somebody approached you?
It, of course, I enjoyed it. I mean, I learned a hell of a lot about telly, and I went on to do a lot of work in television. And, you know, it was a year's wages as well, which is not to be sniffed at when you're trying to earn a living as a writer. But it was a curiously unsettling experience, because the whole mechanics of television was still quite clumsy in those days. Nowadays, with little handheld cameras and so forth, you can be really fleet, you can shoot on the wing. But in those days, you had to set up shots with big clunky cameras on tripods and different lighting for every shot. And the effect of that is that it had to be scripted, but it was coming on to the viewers as fly on the wall. So
it's trying to replicate spontaneity.
Exactly.
So what was your flat like?
It was a kind of averagely seedy, slightly bohemian, book-littered place. You know, Alison was a student still at the university, and I was trying to make a living as a writer. So okay. What do you think it looked like?
Up in Clifton back in the days when it wasn't quite so posh?
No, when it was still very pleasantly seedy.
Yeah. Whereabouts in Clifton for people who live there?
15 the Paragon, £4 a week.
£4 a week, good Lord. So what was it like when they moved in then? Was it like full of wires and lighting rigs?
Oh, yeah, you couldn't move. I mean, you could hardly get up the stairs for the cables in those days, and you needed about three different lights, and it was crammed.
What, in all the rooms?
All the rooms? Where do you think we had? We had one room to live in and do everything in.
Yeah.
A little kitchen like a galley.
Yeah.
And a small bedroom.
Were there lighting rigs and stuff set up in your bedroom and the kitchen?
Yeah, because they shot in both of those.
Right, so not the bathroom, presumably.
No, but we didn't have our own bathroom. We shared our landladies downstairs, okay. So it was pretty difficult. But the trouble was, you see, that the effect of all this was that we felt ourselves turned into characters in somebody's novel, because it was real life scripted in advance.
Yeah.
But we had to try and pretend to be spontaneous. And so, for instance, the most obvious example of this is in the films, there is a shot of Alison lying in bed in hospital being told, "It's twins, dear." Well, of course, she knew that already, but we had...
Did she have to look surprised?
Well, she was doing a drama degree, so it was...
Oh, OK. Maybe she quite enjoyed it then.
She got a bit of experience, yeah. But, yeah, she had to say, "Oh, oh!" That knew she'd heard a fortnight earlier.
Yeah. How many other people did you live with? You said you shared a bathroom. So how many other people in the house were there?
Well, it's a great big house. It's on six or seven floors, that house. It's probably huge, the right. highest house in Bristol, I would think.
Right.
So every floor had its own denizen, you know. I never added it up, but there must have been 12 or 15 people living in the house.
So what did they all think of all of this lot going on? Were they quite excited?
I don't remember any response, really. It was probably a bit of a nuisance for them, actually.
Right.
BBC crews tramping in and out every day for... We'd spent nearly 6 months making that series, a long time.
Yeah. Was John Borman on the set quite a lot?
Oh, he was there non-stop. It was absolutely his film. It wouldn't have happened without him being there. No, that's not quite true. He did have an assistant director called Michael Croucher, who did one of the six episodes.
So was he quite a controlling figure then, if he was there quite
a
lot?
Yeah, he's very much controlling. That's why he, you know, inevitably went on into Hollywood, where you've got total control.
Right.
You know, where you're the auteur, to use that posh word.
So is that a bit like, not only are you having to replicate spontaneous real moments, did you feel like your life was, it wasn't so much your life as John Borman's vision of what your life was, and you were sort of...
That was the problem. It began to feel like that. We began to feel like characters in his novel. And by the end, it was quite unsettling. And I don't know whether people can understand this and imagine it. Most people would think, gosh, you were so lucky, because we were, to be in it, you know, and to be earning our living for 12 months at it. But it did really unsettle me and Alison.
Did you wind up spending like more time elsewhere, like down the pub, to get away from it?
Well, I tried to get away from it, yeah. But I mean, I could get away from it by sitting down and working at my book. I was doing my first novel at the time. Alison had her studies, you know, she was still a student.
It is an interesting question. Like, did it affect you creatively? You must have been, you creatively writing this book, your first novel. Were you in a different headspace because of what was going on around you? Do you think it affected your novel?
I got my revenge on Borman by writing a novel a few years later about a young married couple being televised.
Do you know if he ever read this?
I sent it to him and offered him the film rights.
But he didn't snap them up?
No, unfortunately.
What was the outcome? Did you manage to successfully complete this first novel of yours with all of this stuff going on around you?
Yeah, I finally, not at the time, but yes, I finally got it done, and it came out the following year, 65.
So what, did you have to, like, sort of clock in to your own house and say, well, I'm going to be here at this time, so all the cameras, you know, sort of...
No, we were there anyway. They often woke us up. I'm very bad at waking up in the morning.
Right.
And often I was woken up by the noise of Jim Saunders, the cameraman, lugging his tripod up the stairs, you know. I think, oh, all right, time to get up, you know.
Yeah.
And one day I was filmed doing that, and that was in the film, me actually waking up, literally.
Oh, God forbid, was John Borman in the room?
He was there. He was always there.
Yeah.
And our friend Tom Stopper, who was in Bristol at that time, was there in the early episodes. Later he went away.
How did you wind up being friends with
him? He and I have been journalists together. We got to know each other on the paper.
Okay. So he can be seen sort of in doing various things in the early episodes?
Yeah, he's all over the first episode of that.
So what's the legacy of this been? Has it been generally positive, do you think?
Well,
you personally, from your...
directly for me, apart from the novel that I've just mentioned, directly for me, it launched me into doing telly. There was a company no longer in existence called HTV, and I did about 200 programmes for HTV.
Right.
So that was a way of earning a living for a long time.
Okay.
Not
how about
part of living?
How about Alison? What happened to Alison?
She went into acting in a small company. I mean, never the big time, you know. And then she went into teaching because her parents were teachers, and she'd always fancied the idea of teaching, and so she wound up doing that.
Okay. Are you still married?
Yeah, we're still sharing a house.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've tended to write plays more, I understand, rather than novels and novelisations. So what have you done that, you know, people might have seen or have an opportunity to see?
The one that quite a few people will remember was called Up the Feeder, Down the Mouse. It was done by the Bristol Vic about 10 years ago, and it's about the Bristol docks, the days when there was still a docks in the middle of the city. I mean, where it's now harbour-tide, you know.
Yeah.
When I came to Bristol in 1960, I came to live in this city, you'd see great big ships moored two or three deep along there being loaded and unloaded, you know, and you'd smell, oh, the grain's in today, the cheese is in today from Holland, you know.
Yeah. Do you have any plays performed much now?
Yeah, I had one done at the tobacco factory a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
It took me a long time. I mean, Stoppard knew straight away that that's where he wanted to go, and rather spectacularly, he went there and made one or two people have heard of him. I was always more interested at that time in writing novels, and it took me a long time to find my way into the theatre, but I love it now that when I get to work in it.
If people would like to read a novel, is there any that you've written that are set in Bristol that people can look up?
There are several set in Bristol. I mean, why not, you know? Why not use the area that you know? Why invent a place? So there's one I'm fond of, which most of my novels are, you know, straight novels, i.e. not in a genre, but I've written a couple of thrillers, and they're both set in Bristol, and one is about cricket and doesn't work because I couldn't get the plot right, but one is about racing and does work, I think.
Okay, what's that one called?
The Jericho Gun.
The Jericho Gun?
Yeah.
By Anthony Smith. I thought we'll try looking this up, and perhaps we can even put it as an adaptation read out by Malcolm Grieve on Dialect Radio, who knows. Well, until a future time when we shall meet again and chat, Anthony Smith, thank you very much for chatting.
Pleasure.
Last weekend was the Towpoddle Martyrs Festival in Towpoddle, Dorset. The Towpoddle Martyrs, six men, were imprisoned for forming a trade union in 1834 and consequently deported to Australia and Tasmania. Public outcry brought them back again from the colonies to Dorset. Dialect's Anthea Page was at Towpoddle and interviews the Grassroots Union Choir from Tasmania and meets up with the poet from Swindon Community Radio.
In chains they can bind us and steal all our land. They can mock our religion, from our families divide us, but they can't break the oath of a Towpoddle man. No, they can't break the oath of a Towpoddle man.
Simon, you've come all the way from Tasmania to Towpoddle. Tell us more about it.
Well, we thought, having experienced Graham Moore's Towpoddle Martyrs folk opera, that there's a little bit more of the story to tell. And we wanted to tell the story of George being in our town in Hobart in Tasmania. We put our heads together and wrote a few songs and wrote a script and put the show together, and we started talking to the people over here about it, and they said, bring it over. And this is just a dream come true for all of us to bring this story here and have people appreciate it like they seem to do tonight. It's just really, really exciting.
So do you think George Lovelace, the leader of the Towpoddle Martyrs, is more well-known in Hobart than many parts of England?
Well, that's possible, but I'd say this, that he's better known in Hobart than he was 12 months ago. And we've done, one of the things that we wanted to do was say, we had this famous union figure in Hobart, and people should be inspired by what he did and remember what he did. And that was part of what we wanted to do. So there's more people in Hobart know about it than did a while ago.
So is this your first visit to Towpoddle?
It is. It's just fabulous to be here. It's a sort of almost a pilgrimage for us. We've had a lovely week here. Enjoy very much the English countryside. Yeah, it's just wonderful.
So tell us more about the choir.
Well, this is the Grassroots Union Choir of Tasmania. We're all unionists out of Tasmania. We get together because we love singing songs, in particular the workers' songs and the labour songs, old standards and new ones that we've written ourselves. But there's a message that we want to put out there for people to hear, and we want those songs to be heard.
And will you be singing in the Grand Procession tomorrow?
We'll sing anywhere they'll ask us to. I think we've been invited to sing at the James Hammett wreath laying tomorrow.
So what influence do you think George Lovelace had in Australia?
Well, I think George Lovelace's contribution is in the folklore of the union movement. And it's, I guess, when you remember the things that people have done, not just George, but there's been many, many people over a couple of hundred years now who have put in their bit and done their bit and made their sacrifice. And that's what makes a union movement, and that's what makes things better for working people.
They can mock our religion, from our families divide us, but they can't break the oath of a tall, proud old man. No.
Hello, my name's Tony Hillier. I'm Swindon's community poet, and I bring greetings to your community radio from Swindon Community Radio, 105.5 FM. And here is the banner. Look at the banner. It's got the sycamore tree, the actual sycamore tree symbolised with the brave farm labourers who swore that secret oath and said, no more. Cut our wages no more. We will work not for you for nothing. We will stand our ground. And today I'm looking at a crowd now of 2,000 or 3,000 standing their ground again here in 2011. We will not weaken. We're here today, tomorrow, and forever.
Have you got a poem for us?
I have, in fact. It's called No Secret Anymore. Secret, secret, secret oath, under sycamore they swore, on village green. Dorset farm labourers swore secret oath against the law, against all reason, committed treason under that tree. The oath against the law, but for worker freedom evermore. Thank you. I'm Tony Hillier, Swindon's community poet.
Was Anthea Page reporting from Tobol.
Ask anyone where the first aeroplanes were tested, and most people will think about 1903, of Orville and Wilbur Wright's famous 12-second flight in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. But whilst the Wright brothers achieved the world's first manned flight, much of the glider propeller and aero engine technology used by the Wright brothers was developed and tested in around Somerset, Bath and Bristol. Bristol's famous Filton Airfield is set to close soon to make way for housing, predictably, a sad symbol of Britain's industrial decline, possibly. So over the next few weeks, Dialect is looking back at Bristol and Somerset's role in aviation history. Last week, Dialect's Tony Gosling chatted to Chairman Oliver Dearden about the founding of the British and Colonial Aeroplane Company, the first hangars at Filton, and the design of the famous Bristol box kite. So let's hear a little bit more of Tony Gosling's chat to Oliver Dearden.
1910. In February 1910, Sir George White and his brothers decided that they would go into the aircraft industry, and they founded what was then called the British and Colonial Aeroplane Company, and they based it at Filton on the end of one of his tram routes, so all the people going to work were riding his trams.
But was there actually an airfield there at the time?
No, he just bought the land and set up a small factory. The flying field at that time wasn't where it is now. It was at the top of the hill. It's within what is now the factory. They tried one or two aeroplanes. They bought a French design, which didn't work. But then they designed a thing called a Bristol box kite, which, strangely enough, its first flight was not at Filton. They leased an area of land about 2 miles east of Stonehenge on Salisbury Plain at a place called Lark Hill, which still exists. And they put some hangars there, and they flew the first aircraft from Salisbury Plain.
Now, the box kite is the one that's just inside the museum in Bristol,
indeed,
isn't it?
It's the one that's up in the roof. That's not an original one. There are no original box kites left. The one in the City Museum is one of three that were built for the film The Magnificent Men in the Flying Machines. That's one of them. I think the second one is in Australia, and the third one is with the Shuttleworth Collection in Bedfordshire, and that still flies on very calm summer evenings, but it is a replica.
It does look a little bit like a kite, the box kite, doesn't it? Flimsy looking, with lots of little bits of wire and string, or no, that must be wire, not string, in between the wings. Yes, it's a biplane. You can see why it's called a box, because both the main plane and the tail plane look like they're sort of box shapes.
Yes, they are. I mean, this was very rudimentary. The only thing that they'd worked out was the shape of the wing. They'd worked out how you get lift from what is an aerofoil shape, and the wings today are still basically the same shape.
And I think it's a bit of a mystery for many people how these planes stay up in the sky. It's to do with the shape of the wing must be absolutely crucial, and yes, as the wing starts going through the air, how does it create lift?
The wing is curved as an aerofoil section. As the air flows over the wing, the air going over the top surface, funnily enough, has further to go than the air underneath.
It's a sort of straight line underneath and a slightly rounded line over the top.
No, it's still a curved line underneath, but it's more direct. So the air flowing over the top is actually going slower than the air underneath. And that creates lift because it's a less pressure.
Ah, right.
But the old wings like that were very light. The aircraft only flew at 40 miles an hour.
It is definitely a curved shape, though, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And you'll see aircraft wings today are still curved. Yeah.
So this is the explanation of the mystery as to how they stay up in the sky.
That's right.
Okay, so from the box kite, where did things go then?
The Bristol Company also knew that in order to sell these airplanes, they have to teach people how to fly them. So Larkhill was a flying school, and they taught a lot of pilots to fly. And by the time the war came in 1914, nearly half the people who had licences had been trained by the Bristol Company. There's a picture up there of the hangars at Larkhill, and those hangars still exist today. They're the oldest aircraft hangars in the country.
Underneath, though, those planes that are outside those hangars now, they're not box kites.
No, because they soon moved on to very early monoplanes. They soon worked out that there was rather a better way of doing things than that, and they built some monoplanes. There's an early one there outside that works at Filton. Biplanes were much more common. And the reason for that is, if the aeroplane's got two wings, top and bottom, it's got twice as much wing to do the lift to work the aeroplane, whereas a monoplane has to be much stronger. And there were one or two accidents with monoplanes. They hadn't quite worked out how a cantilever works, and they crashed because they lost the wings.
Oh dear.
And the War Office wouldn't buy monoplanes. They didn't like them. So most of the specifications were for biplanes right through the 1418 war.
So what was the point of the monoplane? Is it just lighter?
It's just lighter. Yes, it's got less drag going forward, you see.
Because with two wings, you've also got all the struts between the wings. Yes, and it looks a little bit more robust, maybe.
It does indeed, but then, I mean, let's face it, there are no biplanes these days. The monoplane won, because it's more efficient.
Yeah. Now, what about the First World War then? What were the planes that were being built in Bristol, which were actually then used in World War One?
The Filton factory built quite a lot of aeroplanes designed by Farnborough. They then developed their own designs. They built the Bristol Scout. There's an example in front of you there. That's a biplane.
That's quite a small plane. Is it probably just for one person, maybe?
Yes, it probably was. That was in the early part of the war. That was followed by, in 1917, they produced what was called the Bristol F2B, the Bristol Fighter, and that was extremely successful. There were over 5,000 of those built, and that was one of the most successful fighters of the First World War. It had a pilot and a gunner.
Now, I seem to remember they had a gun at the front which was timed, especially so it would fire through the propeller.
Yes, indeed. The very early aircraft, they could only fire outside the disc of the propeller. But then, like everybody, somebody came along and invented a synchronised system whereby they could fire through the propeller disc. Yeah. But as you see, the Bristol Fighter here, there's a gun there mounted at the front, fires through the propeller, and there's a Lewis gun on a scarf ring at the back that could fire in any direction. And the gunner sat in the rear cockpit and was facing backwards.
This was the first time, I suppose, that there'd been almost like a sort of little fortress up in the sky guns on the front and the back.
Yes, that's right.
Up until then, what were they actually used for, other than fighting each other? Were they dropping bombs in the First World War?
Not many, because they did smallish bombs. They couldn't carry much. They were mainly fighters. the very early aeroplanes, that before they worked out that they could put guns on them, was a reconnaissance aircraft, because that was one of the interesting things that came out of flying on Salisbury Plain, that these intrepid aviators wandering around the sky at a maximum speed of about 40 miles an hour could see all the army manoeuvres going on down below. Whereas before that, they could only do it from a static balloon, whereas the aeroplane could fly around and see what was happening, and they were very, the early ones were all observation aircraft. Then they became armed, they became fighters, and they did have small bombs, yes.
Thank you very much to Tony Gosling, and thank you very much also to Oliver Dearden, the chairman of the Bristol Aero Collection. It's open on Sundays and Mondays at Kemble Airfield in Gloucestershire. Like Kingswood Heritage Museum in Warmley, the museum on Chard High Street, the Bristol Aero Collection is run entirely by volunteers and faces great funding difficulties, also predictably, unfortunately, as part of the LibCon coalition cuts. So if you do want to visit, do so soon.
Time now for Chapter 14 of Treasure Island, written by Robert Louis Stevenson and read by Malcolm Grieve.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 3, My Shore Adventure. Chapter 14, The First Blow. I was so pleased at having given the slip to Long John that I began to enjoy myself and look around me with some interest on the strange land that I was in. I had crossed a marshy tract full of willows, bulrushes and odd outlandish swampy trees, and I had now come out upon the skirts of an open piece of undulating sandy country, about a mile long, dotted with a few pines and a great number of contorted trees, not unlike the oak in growth, but pale in the foliage like willows. On the far side of the open stood one of the hills, with two quaint craggy peaks, shining vividly in the sun. I now felt, for the first time, the joy of exploration. The isle was uninhabited. My shipmates I had left behind, and nothing lived in front of me but dumb brutes and fowls. I turned hither and thither among the trees. Here and there were flowering plants unknown to me. Here and there I saw snakes, and one raised its head from a ledge in the rock and hissed at me with a noise not unlike the spinning of a top. Little did I suppose that he was a deadly enemy, and that the noise was the famous rattle. Then I came to a long thicket of those oak-like trees, live or evergreen oaks, I heard afterwards they should be called, which grew low along the sand like brambles, the boughs curiously twisted, the foliage compact, like thatch. The thicket stretched down from the top of one of the sandy knolls, spreading and growing taller as it went, until it reached the margin of the broad, reedy fen, through which the nearest of the little rivers soaked its way into the anchorage. The marsh was steaming in the strong sun, and the outline of the spyglass trembled through the haze. All at once, there began to grow a sort of bustle among the bulrushes. A wild duck flew up with a quack, another followed, and soon over the whole surface of the marsh a great cloud of birds hung screaming and circling in the air. I judged at once that some of my shipmates must be drawing near along the borders of the fen. Nor was I deceived, for soon I heard the very distant and low tones of a human voice, which, as I continued to give ear, grew steadily louder and nearer. This put me in great fear, and I crawled under cover of the nearest live oak and squatted there, hearkening, as silent as a mouse. Another voice answered, and then the first voice, which I now recognised to be Silver's, once more took up the story and ran on for a long while in a stream, only now and again interrupted by the other. By the sound they must have been talking earnestly and almost fiercely, but no distinct word came to my hearing. At last the speakers seemed to have paused, and perhaps to have sat down, for not only did they cease to draw any nearer, but the birds themselves began to grow more quiet and to settle again to their places in the swamp. And now I began to feel that I was neglecting my business, that since I had been so foolhardy as to come ashore with these desperadoes, the least I could do was overhear them at their councils, and that my plain and obvious duty was to draw as close as I could manage under the favourable ambush of the crouching trees. I could tell the direction of the speakers pretty exactly, not only by the sound of their voices, but by the behaviour of the few birds that still hung in alarm above the heads of the intruders. Crawling on all fours, I made steadily but slowly towards them, till at last, raising my head to an aperture among the leaves, I could see clear down into a little green dell beside the marsh, and closely set about with trees, where Long John Silver and another of the crew stood face to face in conversation. The sun beat full upon them. Silver had thrown his hat beside him on the ground, and his great, smooth, blonde face, all shining with heat, was lifted to the other man's in a kind of appeal. "Mate," he was saying, "it's because I think gold dust of you. Gold dust, and you may lay to that. If I hadn't took to you like pitch, do you think I'd have been here a warning of you? All's up. You can't make nor mend. It's to save your neck that I'm a-speaking. And if one of the wild uns knew it, where'd I be, Tom? Now tell me, where'd I be?" "Silver," said the other man, and I observed he was not only red in the face, but spoke as hoarse as a crow, and his voice shook too, like a taut rope. "Silver," says he, "you're old, and you're honest, or as the name for it, and you've money too, which lots of poor sailors hasn't, and you're brave or I'm mistook. And will you tell me you'll let yourself be led away with that kind of a mess of swabs? Not you. As sure as God sees me, I'd sooner lose my hand. If I turn again my duty..." And then all of a sudden he was interrupted by a noise. I had found one of the honest hands. Well, here, at that same moment, came news of another. Far away out in the marsh there arose all of a sudden a sound like the cry of anger, and then another on the back of it, and then one horrid, long-drawn scream. The rocks of the spyglass re-echoed it a score of times. A whole troop of marsh birds rose again, darkening heaven with a simultaneous whir. And long after that death yell was still ringing in my brain, silence had re-established its empire, and only the rustle of the redescending birds and the boom of the distant surges disturbed the languor of the afternoon. Tom had leaped at the sound, like a horse at the spur, but Silver had not winked an eye. He stood where he was, resting lightly on his crutch, watching his companion, like a snake about to spring. "John," said the sailor, stretching out his hand. "Hands off," cried Silver, leaping back a yard, as it seemed to me, with the speed and security of a trained gymnast. "Hands off if you like, John Silver," said the other. "It's a black conscience that can make you feared of me. But in heaven's name, tell me, what was that?" "That," returned Silver, smiling away, but warier than ever, his eye a mere pinpoint in his big face, but gleaming like a crumb of glass. "That? Oh, I reckon that'll be Alan." And at this, poor Tom flashed out like a hero. "Alan," he cried. "Then rest his soul for a true seaman. And as for you, John Silver, long you've been a mate of mine, but you're a mate of mine no more. If I die like a dog, I'll die in my duty. You've killed Alan, have you? Killed me too if you can. But I defies you." And with that, this brave fellow turned his back directly on the cook and set off walking for the beach. But he was not destined to go far. With a cry, John seized the branch of a tree, whipped the crutch out of his armpit, and sent that uncouth missile hurtling through the air. It struck poor Tom point foremost, and with stunning violence, right between the shoulders, in the middle of his back. His hands flew up, he gave a sort of gasp, and fell. Whether he were injured much or little, none could ever tell. Like enough, to judge from the sound, his back was broken on the spot. But he had no time given him to recover. Silver, agile as a monkey even without leg or crutch, was on the top of him next moment, and had twice buried his knife up to the hilt in that defenceless body. From my place of ambush, I could hear him pant aloud as he struck the blows. I do not know what it rightly is to faint, but I do know that for the next little while the whole world swam away from before me in a whirling mist. Silver and the birds and the tall spyglass hilltop going round and round and topsy-turvy before my eyes, and all manner of bells ringing and distant voices shouting in my ear. When I came again to myself, the monster had pulled himself together, his crutch under his arm, his hat upon his head. Just before him, Tom lay motionless upon the sword. But the murderer minded him not a whit, cleansing his blood-stained knife the while upon a wisp of grass. Everything else was unchanged, the sun still shining mercilessly upon the steaming marsh and the tall pinnacle of the mountain. And I could scarce persuade myself that murder had been actually done, and a human life cruelly cut short a moment since, before my eyes. But now John put his hand in his pocket, brought out a whistle, and blew upon it several modulated blasts that rang far across the heated air. I could not tell, of course, the meaning of the signal, but it instantly awoke my fears. More men would be coming. I might be discovered. They had already slain two of the honest people. After Tom and Alan, might I not come next? Instantly I began to extricate myself and crawl back again with what speed and silence I could manage to the more open portion of the wood. As I did so, I could hear hails coming and going between the old buccaneer and his comrades. And this sound of danger lent me wings. As soon as I was clear of the thicket, I ran as I never ran before, scarce minding the direction of my flight, so long as it led me from the murderers. And as I ran, fear grew and grew upon me, until it turned into a kind of frenzy. Indeed, could anyone be more entirely lost than I? When the gun fired, how should I dare to go down to the boats among those fiends still smoking from their crime? Would not the first of them who saw me wring my neck like a snipe's? Would not my absence itself be an evidence to them of my alarm, and therefore of my fatal knowledge? It was all over, I thought. Goodbye to the Hispaniola, goodbye to the squire, the doctor, and the captain. There was nothing left for me but death by starvation, or death by the hands of the mutineers. All this while, as I say, I was still running, and without taking any notice, I had drawn near to the foot of the little hill with the two peaks, and had got into a part of the island where the live oaks grew more widely apart, and seemed more like forest trees in their bearing and dimensions. Mingled with these were a few scattered pines, some 50, some nearer 70 feet high. The air, too, smelt more freshly than down beside the marsh. And here, a fresh alarm brought me to a standstill with a thumping heart.
That was Chapter 14 of Treasure Island, written by Robert Louis Stevenson and read by Malcolm Grieve. So our next guest is an artist called Will Player.
Hello.
Hi. So tell us about the Great Seals and the history behind it.
Well, the Great Seals were designed around the time of the American Revolution, which is 1776, and they were designed specifically to be used as a wax seal for, like, treaties between countries and stuff. And they were basically commissioned so the United States could be recognised as an independent state from England.
Great. Okay, so why the dollar bill? What's the history behind it and what's the fascination with it?
It's just a fascinating note. When you look at other notes of other nations, they're generally, like, quite dull and boring. But on the back of the $1 bill, you have what some people suggest is occult Illuminati symbolism, and especially the pyramid with the eye above it.
Okay, so is there any specific interest or symbol of the dollar bill when you work at it or look at it, or is it just the whole thing that fascinates you?
I suppose I have colour blindness, which I'm red-green deficient, so I see detail, I suppose, in a different way to people, and maybe that is why I can see these images. And basically, it's just a logical, I do a logical approach towards the designing of the images, and you just have ideas which you then just follow through, and then one picture looks good and the other picture doesn't look good, so you keep the good picture, and then you have another idea, oh well, I could do it like that way and stuff. And, you know, over years and stuff, it develops into quite a massive project, and at present I have 153 separate images.
Wow.
Yeah, and I've designing more as
So how did you get into this? I mean, what's your background as an artist?
I have no background as an artist. I actually got a U in my mock GCSE art, and yeah, they used my final piece as basically like some hamster bedding or something.
So how did you get into it? Is it just a case of...
One of my friends told me about it,
and he
had been told it by one of his friends who had apparently heard it on David Icke. And David Icke said that if you got two notes and cross them over each other, then you could see occult symbolism inside the dollar bill, which is very true. There is a great deal of occult symbolism in these images, which makes it fascinating, to go back to your first question.
And is it just you that does this, or are there others?
As far as I know, it is just me. There doesn't seem to be anything like this on the internet. There's a lot of documentaries explaining the significance of the dollar bill and the occult significance of the dollar bill, but nobody has, it seems, that has created these images. If they have, they certainly haven't published them.
And you have a business, or
I'm trying to start up a small business selling these images, and I've got I'm designing a website. The web address is www.dollarbillart.com.
Fantastic. So if anyone wants to know more information, they can contact you on there?
In a couple of weeks when it becomes online. But that is the domain name where the website will exist.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Now we have Tim Burrows in a two-part interview talking to Michaela Dennis about his new CD, which combines music and poetry. This is part two.
It's kind of audience participation as well as highlighting the themes of the poem more, and there just seems to be quite a lot of benefit in doing something.
Also
in,
making
in this
it part
way.
Of an event, I guess. I think that's nice when you get people as their part of the event instead of it as can be too much of a barrier.
The performance of poetry as you say, quite, it is just the spoken word, and in the empty kind of emptiness of a room, it can get not lost, but especially if there's lots of poetry one after the other, I can imagine that people kind of struggle with that as a kind of as a concept.
I think that's another thing I found, having gone to, you know, performed at spoken word events. Often music's brought in as a separate with musicians as a sort of in the interval, but I think it's nice to have a form that's in the middle, so I could do some poetry and then I can add some backing to give it, make more of a show, I guess.
Yeah. You know? Well, I mean, let's listen to another poem now. This is Sea Necklace. I mean, have you just a quick brief background before people hear this one?
I wrote this one. I love Cornwall, and I wrote this in Tresco, which is one of the Isles of Scilly, and it is a very beautiful island, and it's a small island, and I've always loved islands that you can kind of walk around in a couple of hours, and that you can do that, and that was my tribute to the beauty of Tresco, I guess.
Sea Necklace. Nothing but the sound of sea on sand, the rhythmic slap of waves beating on the shore, the pulse of the white moon overhead talking to the land, bringing in salt sea, gifts from the deep, kelp, wrack, shells and razorbacks, natural beads to fill the necklace of the sea round the island. Link the land to the sky, the pulse of unity, the natural cycle, part of you and I.
So that was Sea Necklace by Tim Burrows. And that one, I can imagine if someone described the idea of a soundscape, this is the traditional kind of thing they think about. You know, you're talking about the sea and there's the sound of the sea. You know, it's quite you know, a straightforward notion. But I mean, is there anything extra that brings, do you think, apart from just evoking the environment, the kind of the place?
Yeah, I think it adds. I mean, I think I myself going through the debate, sometimes you try and put something extra like music backing or sound effects backing to a piece and it doesn't add. You have to, in the end, say, no, it's better as a straight spoken word. But sometimes other ones, and the sea is such a... I've done various recordings of the sea to try and use kind of like live sea recordings, but it's such a beautiful thing that it's such a strong element to that poem that it just adds that. It kind of brings it home.
I think I really like this one, and it's just so short. It's so brief. It's there and then it's faded away again. And actually, I kind of noticed a few other kind of soundscapes are quite short, really, compared to some maybe the other poems that we've kind of heard you you do over the course of, you know, coming in here at Dialect. So I was just wondering, I mean, is there a particular reason why the soundscapes are maybe a bit shorter than your other work, or would you disagree with that?
I think a piece is just comes out, it's as long as it needs to be, and I think you often edit down. Sometimes you add things, rework things, but I think it's, I don't think a soundscape has to be short or long, but it depends what the subject matter is, and things tend to kind of have their natural length. I sometimes like to do short things, and sometimes it'd be quite nice to do a long piece where you could almost have different musical elements or movements or themes or recurring themes, you know, in music or in sound. I mean, another thing I'm interested in is the idea of incantation and, you know, where does poetry stop and incantation or, you know, start? And those kind of areas, again, I like the edges of things, and you go between one genre and another, and you've got this interesting, it's like language changing over geography as you move cross country, you know. It's kind of, yeah, this thing is interesting. You find new things, you know, on the edges.
And the final poem that we're going to take from Soundscape is In Death's Valley. And this one is pretty heavy going, really. It's pretty, you know, heavy going subject matter. Really well done, I think. But I mean, could you give a bit of background about this one as well?
That one is obviously about Israel and Palestine, which is actually such a sad and terrible situation. And I can remember seeing yet another news clip of the new wall with a Palestinian widow actually coming, because a lot of old Palestinian olive groves had been bulldozed to make way for the wall. It was great to see this widow turning up with to replanting her olives, because it seemed that against all that terror and destruction and bloodshed, there was this positive mode that things will go on. You know, there may be a time where the wall is pulled down again and communities can start living together again and stop fighting and stop, you know, oppressing. It's obviously there's such strong emotions around the whole, you know, that whole subject.
This is In Death's Valley.
In Death's Valley. Ruled by the Bible and the gun, ruled by the Quran and the bomb, divided by walls and cultural chasms, driven by hate and inequality, dying the same in pale equality, dying the same in gory equality. Widows and fatherless children, flowers and photographs in cemeteries, trees line the avenues of death. Wails of mourning drown out the birdsong at dawn. A low lament covers the songs of joy, a stone replaces the child's toy. No sun in the sky this day, whirring helicopters of death fill the sky, bringing swift death by missile, a savage bolt from on high. Palestine, the angel of death hovers above you, spitting death, preaching separation, crying tears, delivering desolation. Your sons and daughters and those of Israel dwell in the valley of the skull, dying both oppressed by division, growing the bitter fruit of enmity, turning words of spirit into the poison of hatred. But a widow, her cheeks lined with dust and tears, her heart full of sorrow and fears, carries a small olive tree to the wall, a symbol of lost orchards buried beneath. Yet, also a prayer for hope, ripe fruit for future generations.
So in Death Valley, there's a lot going on. I mean, there's low kind of drums, there's kind of a wailing almost kind of in the background. Would you describe it as wailing?
Yes, I think it's kind of ululating. I used a loop for that. It's which in that part of the world, especially if Palestinian people die, the women will ululate to let their bereavement out and their pain and their sorrow out. So that was very definite. And I found it had to have that. It had to have drums. Drums being a very kind of military thing. As I say, sometimes you've got the subject matter demands things.
Yeah.
Like some, you know, for example, I'd love to be able to work with, say, choirs or have more choir loops, because I use Apple loops sometimes when I can't do a live thing myself, and sometimes classical music things like bringing in cellos and things. But I think the voice is such a great thing. Working with a choir would be great, because you've got the thing, but that's obviously, you've got to persuade lots of people to do it, you know.
It's true, but you've got to be ambitious about these things, haven't you?
Yes. No, it'd be great to actually work with a choir or something and that, because the human voice is just such an incredible instrument. So I can bring, sound is used in film, a sound background, because you can use those sorts of effects in it again. You know, I mean, I think the great thing about it, and I hope it will do this for the audience, is it gets my imagining running right, because you've got one piece that you take some words or you take a piece of music and you add the words one way or the music the other way. But it often gets me thinking more about the piece, and sometimes you'll change it a bit because actually in the round, it didn't, you know, there are things that could be made better.
I found the sounds very kind of military inspired. There's an oppressiveness. It's quite intense with the wailing and the drums, and it very sad. But then, like you say, in terms of the words and the olive tree and the hope, actually I found there's quite a stark contrast there between what the sound was and where it was taking me, and then what the actual words were saying. So I expect that, you know, that's obviously something intentional,
but some of them definitely didn't work, adding things, sound effects, live music or midied in stuff didn't work, didn't add anything. There's some spoken word pieces that the word is just enough. You know, the voice, as you know from the radio, is just such a strong thing. Yeah.
Thank you very much, as ever, to Tim Burrows, a regular on this show, and also to Michaela.
Finally, Jeff Sparks is here with the What's On Guide.
Thank you. Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Thursday, 4th of August, Karma to Burn will be performing with support from Black Spiders and also Gentlemen's Pistols at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. On to Friday, 5th of August, the Dickies will be performing with support from Mike TV and also Two Sick Monkeys at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £14 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I present Jeff Beck. In 2010, he released an album titled Emotion and Commotion, which showcases a 64-piece orchestra, covers of well-known songs, as well as other rock and classical works. This is the song Ness and Dorma, which won a Grammy Award for Best Pop Instrumental Performance. Thank you. was Jeff Beck with Nesant Dorma from the album Emotion and Commotion. For more information, check out www.jeffbeck.com. Keeping with 5th of August, Off will be performing with support from Trash Talk at the Thecla, which is at the Grove in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £12.50 in advance. Finally, on Saturday 6th of August, the Imperials will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Muse, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £5 in advance. That's all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
That's all from Dialect this week. Studio guests were Anthony Smith and features were by Tony Godlin, Michaela Dellis and Anthea Page. Malcolm Grieve read Part 3, Chapter 14 of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. And the What's On Guide was by Jeff Sparks. The presenters were John Peters Coleman, myself, Sophia Costa. The engineer was Michael Noyce. The producer was Alec Milne. Thank you.